So two of my three predictions have already come true. Yes, there will be a trial in the Senate of former President Trump. Unconstitutional as it is, I predicted the Senate would vote that way. I also predicted that the Chief Justice would not preside, nor would the Vice President. Two out of three. We'll wait to see if the third prediction, an acquittal largely on the ground of lack of jurisdiction, will also become reality. That's the past. Now we're going to talk about the future. I have a great, great interview subject today, Will Chamberlain, a young voice of the future, somebody who is very important on social media, someone who presents an argument in favor of free speech and against censorship. He has some great, innovative, interesting ideas on how to deal with censorship on the internet. So please stay tuned and listen carefully to our guest, Will Chamberlain. On today's Dirt Show, we have an extraordinary guest, somebody who's had a big impact on social media, represents a kind of dissenting view from that which we hear from many in today's media. He's an older millennium person and doesn't necessarily reflect the views, but understands the views of his age contemporaries. And we'll have an opportunity to dig deeply into what the future of social media may look like. But before we get to the future, I want to go to the past for just a minute and bring you up to date on what's going on with the impeachment and removal trial of former President Trump. Two of my three predictions that I made over the past several days came true yesterday. I still have the third one that's outstanding. I predicted the Senate would vote to put the former president on trial, even though in my view that's unconstitutional. I was also right when I said that the presiding officer would neither be the Chief Justice, because this is not the trial of a president, nor the vice president, although she's entitled to preside. I think she sees that it would create a possible conflict of interest because she may be the candidate for the Democratic Party running against the man that she's trying to disqualify by this impeachment. And so two out of three so far. We still have the third prediction, and that is that the president will be acquitted and will be acquitted in large part because there won't be enough votes on the jurisdictional issue. Well, I said there were already enough votes on the jurisdictional issue, so what did I mean? All you need is a simple majority to get jurisdiction, but then you need two-thirds to convict, and if there's more than one-third that doesn't think there is jurisdiction, they will vote to acquit, either on the jurisdictional grounds or on the merits. So although things could change, this is not a 100% prediction, I'm fairly confident that we will see a trial with a lot of posturing, and in the end, there'll be an acquittal. The thing that really gets me annoyed is Majority Leader Schumer. He knows better. He graduated Harvard Law School. He's a smart guy. All right, I can understand him saying it's a close question on jurisdiction. I think there is jurisdiction. The Constitution, after all, does say that a president not only can be removed, but he can be disqualified. All right, I can see him saying it's a close question. But for Chuck Schumer, there are no such things as close questions. He is such an extremist in his views, as are most of the leaders of the Democratic Party today, Jamie Raskin, Adam Schiff. For them, they know it's a close question. At least they won't admit it. Oh, no, it's open and shut. It's crystal clear. Every scholar in the world agrees that there's jurisdiction. Nonsense. It may be true that most scholars say there's jurisdiction. They don't believe it. They know it's a close question. But for them, they hide their partisan political outcomes under the veneer of scholarship. And so Schumer's doing the same thing. There will be a trial. It will probably be a relatively short trial. There's not going to be a lot of disagreement about evidence. There may be disagreement about causal relationship between the president's speech, the former president's speech on December 6th, and what happened, the horrible events that happened in the Capitol. But there won't be a dispute about the speech because it's all on videotape. Although some of the major media always leave out of the speech Trump's statement that he wants peaceful and patriotic protest, that will be seen by the Senate. CNN will probably take that part out the way they always do, but at least the senators will see everything. So that's my rant for the morning. Now we'll go on to a very serious conversation with Will Chamberlain, who is an editor. And why don't you tell us, Will, your own background, just a little bit about who you are and what you do today, so my viewers and listeners will have a better sense of what you represent and what kind of questions they can put to you and I can put to you. Will?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Alan. I guess we can go back to even around the college age. I played poker for a living very briefly all the way back in 2003. So we can talk about
what would you play? Would you play Hold'em? Would you play Hold'em?
Yeah, Hold'em. I mean, yeah. That was really the only game. So limit and no limit Hold'em.
You'll be interested. You'll be interested. I was once asked to take a case about whether poker is gambling. And I said, no, poker is a game of skill, which has elements of gambling, as every game of skill has elements of gambling. And I said to the court, the best proof that it's a game of skill is that I lose all the time. If it were, in fact, a game of chance, I'd win, you know, at least 40, 50% of the time. But I lose all the time to much more skilled players. So I'm sure you are a winner and a skilled player. So you are a poker player. That's a very, very important attribute of life today in the world, to understand risks and make important decisions based on risks. What else?
Okay. And so I ultimately, I went to College at University of the Pacific, where I competed in the parliamentary debate on the national circuit, coached that for another 2 years at the University of Oregon, and then law school at Georgetown, graduated in 2015, briefly practiced at Quinn Emanuel as a litigator. And then
great law firm.
Yeah.
Did you know Kathleen Sullivan?
I never met Kathleen. She was in the New York office. I was out in LA with John Quinn and a few others. Although I just
Kathleen was one of my real star students. The first couple of years I taught at Harvard, I identified her literally on day one and said, this is a woman who will accomplish anything she wants. And of course, she became the dean of Stanford Law School, a great professor at Harvard, the first woman to have her name on a Wall Street firm, and a great, great litigator.
Indeed. After that, I transitioned to nonprofit and worked at the Competitive Enterprise Institute on their class action fairness litigation. So I don't know if you're familiar with Ted Frank and his work, but he objects to unfair class action settlements. So I did some work on that. But ultimately I've transitioned kind of into more politics and advocacy. I now, in 2019, so 2 years ago, I purchased Human Events and now co-publish it at humanevents.com. And I also serve as senior counsel to the Internet Accountability Project and the Article 3 Project. The Internet Accountability Project is focused on fighting social media censorship and big tech's abuses. And the Article 3 Project was focused on confirming President Trump's judicial appointees.
So my first question to you is, what's wrong with your generation? Why don't your contemporaries have a greater appreciation for freedom of speech, dissent, due process? Before you even answer that question, do you know people in your generation like that? Do they talk to you? Or are you, because you're a dissenter on many of these issues, are you a pariah with others in that generation?
It varies. I mean, there are some people who really do see me as this horrible figure. I find that bizarre. But there are plenty of others who, while practicing Ketman in their daily lives, you know, come to me in their private moments to confess that indeed they don't think everything is okay and they really feel horribly censored. In general, though, I mean, not to shift the blame for my generation, but they're only doing what they were taught. With my experiences on university campuses,
taught by my generation. So you're going to put the blame on my generation.
We can put it on Generation X or something like that, and say that they're the bad professors that taught my generation poorly. But I see, you know, a lot of what happened on university campuses is essentially this just radical acceleration of left-wing ideas there. And as a result, it went from a place where maybe in 2008, 2009, you could be a Republican, people wouldn't really see a problem with that, to a point where by 2015, that was just seen as truly beyond the pale. And the debate was really between the liberals and the leftists. And honestly, the liberals, I feel like they really just didn't have an effective defense to the consistent left-wing advances ideologically, because they were conceding some of these basic premises. Like if the single most important value is anti-racism, and if that's the single most important value you have and it just trumps everything else, then why do you need to tolerate speech that is secondary if it interferes with the anti-racist project? And so the inability to say there, the lack of grounding in values that other than anti-racism, freedom, liberty, I think ultimately is sort of responsible for some of the acceleration you're seeing and why free speech isn't that valued on the left, on the right, or in
is anti-race. Is anti-racism really anti-racism? Take, for example, the woman who has just been nominated to become the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, Christine Clark, I think. She purports to be an anti-racist, but her own writings and history show that she believes that blacks are racially superior, that the amount of melanin that you have in your skin determines your intelligence and your energy level. When she was a student at Harvard, she invited a professor from Wellesley who believed that Jews dominate and control the slave trade in the world, and that blacks are superior in every way. So are we talking about anti-racism here, or are we talking about kind of racial preferences and identity politics? Is the goal of anti-racism really anti-racism and equality? Is it Martin Luther King's dream that his children will be judged by the quality of their character rather than the color of their skin? Or is it something else?
Well, I mean, again, it depends on how you define racism. And the left notices that and wages what I call semantic campaigns to redefine words so that they can only be used to their benefit. So, I mean, think about the formulation of racism equals prejudice plus power. That's a very common one that you see now, and it, you know, there's a rationale for it, right? Well, maybe if you have power, sure, then discrimination and prejudice is worse. Okay, I understand your rationale, but it seems very convenient.
Who has the power? They define power in a racist way. They don't say you particularly have the power, but you're a Jew, and therefore you belong to a group that has power, as if all Jews exercise that power in the same way. It's a variation of the protocols of the elders of Zion. And I focus only on Jews here, but they say the same thing about whites. If you're pale and Yale and male, you have power. It doesn't matter if your family came from the Ozarks and you worked your way up. If you fit those three classifications, you have power. Isn't that a form of racism, a form of identity politics? Isn't all identity politics essentially a form of racial identification, or identifications based on factors that aren't necessarily relevant?
I think properly understood, you're right. I think part of, but you know, just understanding what the left's project is, it's to take these incredibly powerful weighted ideas and things that we want to avoid, and then essentially shape them so that they can very easily be applied to one's adversaries in the out-group. And it's very difficult to then apply that definition to people within the in-group. And ironically, that power to define what words mean is sort of a power that should be conceived of as part of the power plus prejudice formulation as well, right? If you have the ability to define what these words mean, are you really that powerless? And I think a really broad problem in the academy, and they've sort of embraced it all the way. And so, I mean, I remember, you know, as I said, I did college debate. I remember watching a final national championship debate round. I had a video of it. I don't know that it ever got published, but the winning team included basically, it was a team of two black students and facing off against two white students. And one of the black students said, "The reason you should vote for us, Judge, is because that means the white person will lose, and it will be good for them to lose. It's good for them to feel like reduced to this." And it's shocking. It's nothing that resembles anything close to what debate should look like. But it's a natural byproduct of this really insidious ideology in the academy.
Well, it's spreading beyond the academy. I'm a big baseball fan, and one of my transforming events of my baseball life was when the Boston Red Sox were behind the Yankees 3-0 and came back and not only won 4 games in a row to win the American League championship, but then the World Series. And of course, the star of that was a pitcher named Curt Schilling. And Curt Schilling has been kept out of the Hall of Fame now, I think, 9 years in a row, plainly because of his politics. And today, if you are a great pitcher, but you're politically incorrect in your attitudes, you're not going to make it into the Hall of Fame. And so, obviously, it's permeating all aspects of society. How do we fight back? How do true egalitarians who believe in process, who believe in free speech, who believe in due process, who believe in equal opportunities, who believe in trying to make the starting point the same for all people, hard as that may be, how do we persuade your generation and the generation after your generation, how do we persuade them that this is ultimately a better approach than basing things on race, gender, and other forms of identity that are essentially immutable?
I mean, it's a massive problem. I think there are basically two places you would need to focus, just off the top of my head. One is the universities. I don't know how you fix the radical left-wing shift, but I think that one smart thing to do would be to have a massive political diversity push. I think it's totally unacceptable that, the entire American population funds these universities, public universities, and many of their departments are staffed by 95% to 100% Democrats and not a single Republican. We should see that as unacceptable. I think if we expect our students to be going and getting a broad education, a pluralist understanding of the world, if they're going to departments that have zero conservatives or colleges that have a 2% conservative professoriate, we should see that as basically unacceptable and not worthy of any government subsidy.
How do you change it? The departments claim that they're picking people on their merits. They're not putting them behind screens and making them play the viola and picking them the way the Boston Symphony Orchestra picks them. But they claim they're just picking the best chemists, the best biologists, the best political scientists, the best everything. And they just happen to turn out all to be radical leftists. I'm going to give you just two examples. Brooklyn College, which I went to. And I was a star student at Brooklyn College, captain of the debate team like you and all of that. I can't get invited to speak at Brooklyn College today because I'm pro-Israel. And no department will invite a pro-Israel speaker. At Berkeley, for example, they have a new rule. And that is if a department invites you, you can come tomorrow. But if it's just students who invite you, then you have to wait 8 weeks and go through this and that, and the semester is over. And so I was invited by a student group to go, and no department would invite me to contest the BDS movement, the boycott movement against Israel. And so I couldn't speak, and I threatened to file a federal lawsuit saying you're practicing de facto discrimination based on viewpoint as a public university. And of course, the university folded. And the dean of the law school invited me on behalf of the law school, and everything went forward, and we had a great conversation and a great debate. But I can't get invited today to speak at universities by faculty because of my pro-Israel views. Some people think my pro-Trump views. I'm not pro-Trump. I'm pro-Constitution. But nonetheless, because I defended Trump on the floor of the Senate, my invitations are no longer forthcoming. How do we fight that? I agree with you that today, when you hear diversity, it's a euphemism for more people like us. That's what diversity means. Diversity means more people who look like us and think like us and act like us. The last thing most diversity parts of universities want is diverse political views. They don't go to the Ozarks and recruit. They don't go to poor white areas and recruit. They don't recruit people who favor the Second Amendment, people who have strong views about border control. That's not the kind of diversity they want. They want people to look different but think the same.
Right. I agree. And I also agree with this, the need to focus on what are we going to do about it. I don't know that it would work, but the only obvious way to like even start to redress this, I think, and to sort of attack the whole problem broadly, is to think about making political affiliation a protected class, to the point that we say we have all these different anti-discrimination laws that have effectively worked. I mean, you know, when you think about what you're just talking about, how all these universities employ nothing but radical leftists, and they say, well, you know, we're just, you know, looking at the merits of the candidates, and we just happen to only have leftists. Well, that wouldn't fly if we were talking about race, or that wouldn't fly if we were talking about religion. Like, oh, you just happen to only employ white professors. Like, no, we see the problem there. You would have to fix things, and you would be facing serious litigation if you didn't fix things. Well, it sounds like perhaps we need to do a similar thing with political affiliation, that if a university can't find a way to staff with at least 10% conservative Republican mm-hmm. professors, then perhaps we just, you know, that's de facto evidence that you are discriminating against conservatives. Right.
So I have a humorous question for you. You know, the great criminal lawyer back in the 1920s, he always, when he had a trial, they allowed you to smoke cigarettes in the courtroom back in the day. This is Clarence Darrow. And what he would mm-hmm. do is he would smoke a cigarette and he'd put a wire through the cigarette. And so the ash would never fall off when he smoked the cigarette. And when his opponent was making important points, he would always smoke the cigarette, and the jurors would see the ash wasn't falling off, and they would just focus and concentrate, when is the ash going to fall off? So I'm looking at you, and I see your books behind you in a pile that look like they're going to fall any second now. How do you keep those books up, and how do you make sure...
It's like, watch out.
Oh, no. Look at the books. Look at the books. I never fall. Okay. So what's your point? What do you have those books behind? It's a bookshelf.
So this is a bookshelf. These are little shelves. It's a little bit of an illusion. So that's
now
what's happening
we
there.
Can come back and we can focus on you. We don't have to think about when those books are going to fall on you. Okay. Political protection of political ideology. That's a very interesting idea. How do you do that? I mean, remember, political ideology is not quite like race, although race doesn't fall into, binary classification. Gender doesn't any longer fall into a binary classification. At least we know it when we see it. What political views would have to be included in protected classes? You'd say conservatives, but even conservatives today, the Federalist Society was very prominent when I was teaching at Harvard, and it represented a kind of centrist conservative view. And there are today many to the right of the Federalist Society as well, likewise on the left. Obviously, I'm a liberal. And the people I hate the most politically in the world are radical leftists who I think are intolerant and often anti-Semitic and often anti-intellectual in every possible way. How do you create categories that would make political ideology a protected class?
I mean, you're actually getting an area where I'm, I guess, less confident about the right answer, because, I mean, it is really challenging. And because also, if you're talking about political affiliation, okay, what about, let's go all the way to the extreme. What about neo-Nazis or what about communists?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, how much protection do they deserve? Are there situations where that, I mean, I think even some of our current statutes, you know, explicitly allow discrimination yeah. against communists.
Well, in fact, I began my political career at Brooklyn College, which was known as the Little Red Schoolhouse, because it had been a center of communism, as City College was in the 1930s, Brooklyn College was in the 1940s. And they brought in a president from the Midwest to rid Brooklyn College of communism. And one of the leaders of the effort to rid Brooklyn College of communism was a man named Professor Eugene Scalia, a brilliant, wonderful professor whose son you may have heard of. He became Justice mm-hmm. Scalia, whose grandson obviously is a very prominent member of the Republican leadership today. And I was fighting to make sure that communists could not be excluded from teaching. The best math professor I had in high school was a former communist, Mr. Wallach. And he was just brilliant, never allowed his political views to interfere with geometry and trigonometry, but he was fired from the public schools, fortunately came to my little yeshiva, where he was a phenomenal professor. And I didn't even know whether he was really a communist or just somebody who may have been a fellow traveler or refused to answer questions about his communism. So, but you're right. I mean, what do you do if David Duke gets a PhD and decides he wants to apply to teach at a major school? And if there were blind grading, he would get the position, but do we really want our students to be taught by neo-Nazis? I'll tell you my position. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would, if you required a David Duke or a communist to be not discriminated against in order to bring real political diversity to a university, I would say the marketplace of ideas could tolerate that. It doesn't mean students would have to sign up for his classes. It doesn't mean that he gets ratings of the most popular teacher. Maybe he would. Who knows? Maybe he will convince some students. But if you genuinely really believe in the marketplace of ideas, then you shouldn't really have exclusions based on ideology. Let's defeat them in the marketplace of ideas.
Right. And I mean, in a sense, I think it's really important. I think there's a lot of value as a conservative student that I got out of going into a place like Georgetown Law and just facing off against very, very talented, brilliant liberal professors all the time.
I had the same experience. Yeah. I had John Hospers as my favorite professor of ethics and philosophy at Brooklyn College. John Hospers ultimately became a libertarian candidate for president of the United States, very much a supporter of Ayn Rand and others. I learned so much. And even from students, I learned a lot from Ted Cruz when he was a student in my class, because he always asked the most provocative questions. The students did not love him all the time. In fact, they used to play Cruz Bingo. They had a series of key words that Cruz would always say. And when he said it, they would mark off their bingo cards. And then at the end, whoever had the most Cruz bingos would have to say something in class contradictory to Cruz. But, you know, students learned a lot from Cruz. And I think maybe Cruz learned a lot from students. I'm sure your experience at Georgetown was very, very enlightening to you.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, I was sort of used as the foil for some, like Paul Butler, for example, would routinely call on me in criminal procedure because he could count on me to take the sort of conservative position in all these cases, which I'm honestly kind of more of a civil libertarian and generally skeptical of mass incarceration, things like that. But on the specific questions in criminal procedure where, you know, he'd be like, is there reasonable suspicion here? I'd be like, yeah, there's reasonable suspicion here. Why is this person behaving so strangely on the street? Clearly, the police should be, you know, the police officers should be able to stop them. I was routinely called upon for that. And I always found that I love the Socratic method and being essentially forced to defend myself and
Well, you know, the Socratic method is dying at law schools today. Some law schools won't allow Socratic teachers to teach first year students because the snowflakes in the class are upset by being asked hard questions. And the worst thing that ever happened to law school teaching are the popularity contests, the students' evaluations, because the student evaluations, the best evaluations, go to the professors who never contradict anything the students want to hear. I call them academic massage therapists. They're there to just make life easy for the students, to reaffirm everything the students came in with, never to challenge them, never to question them, to give them more ammunition to go out into the world and think that they are completely truthful and correct in everything they say. And teachers, therefore, incline in that direction. When I first started teaching, the teachers who got the best evaluations were those who were most confrontational, those who were most challenging. And today, the political correctness among teaching is not to challenge the students. And so the Socratic method is dying. And we're seeing more and more teachers just lecturing and using other methods and not confronting students. But I don't think we're getting better results from our teaching from that methodology.
No, certainly not. I mean, the Socratic method, if you want to listen to a lecture at this point, I mean, you could listen to a podcast. I don't know, to me, just like straight listening to someone talking for 60 minutes is so relatively less valuable than a Socratic mm-hmm. exchange where, you know, you're pressed to not just think through the answer to this question, but think through, okay, how is this position defensible? Like, what angles are they going to come at me from? And can I defend this from an examination? Right. You can't replicate
not what
that
to
with
think.
A lecture.
Right. Not what to think, but how to think. I had a rule in my 50 years of teaching. Never say anything in a class that the students could look up in a book. Mm-hmm. Everything in the classroom had to be something they could not find in a book. And that book would include my own writings. So if I've already written it, hey, I can assign it. The students can read it. But the classroom, those 90 minutes or those 60 minutes are reserved for how to think about things you cannot find in books. And today, I think that's not going on. So I want to talk to you about the future of free speech. We've bemoaned the lack of appreciation for free speech by students who think they know the truth. And what do you need dissent if you know the truth? If you think that every woman who's ever accused a man is, of course, telling the truth, why do you need due process? Just base convictions on accusations. If you think that you know the answer to the complexity of racial problems in America, why do you need dissenting points of view on that? In something I'm writing now, I'm arguing that your generation is already having a tremendous influence on the newsrooms and the social media. And 10, 15 years from now, when you're in your late 40s or mid 40s, you will be the CEOs of all the major companies. You will be the editors in chief of the New York Times. You'll be the majority leader of the Senate. You'll be the presidential candidate. How do we stop these anti-libertarian attitudes that are so pervasive among people in their 30s today from becoming the dominant culture? How do we make sure that cancel culture does not become American culture in the years to come?
Well, here's where I actually think I have a decent answer. And that is, you know, I'm a big believer in the idea that we need new laws that protect everybody's right to speak on social media. So I see social media as the basic public square. I think that the proper way to conceptualize the right to speak on social media is as a civil right. I think of, you know, constitutional rights protections from what the government can do, but then a civil right is something that it's so important, so paramount that we say private companies can't infringe on that either. And so I think, you know, if we have laws that say you have the right to use Facebook and Twitter as long as you're speaking lawfully, as long as you're not breaking the law. And then moreover, the way to enforce that would be a kind of a private right of action. If Facebook or Twitter wrongfully censors you, you can go walk into court, get an injunction, and get attorney's fees and maybe some statutory damages too. And that's just the baseline.
But why does that not violate the First Amendment rights of Twitter and Facebook, who also have the right to decide what will be on their platform? Would you apply the same rule to the New York Times if I write a letter to the editor of the New York Times and they refuse to publish it? Obviously, they have to refuse to publish 99% of the letters they get. But if they refuse to publish it on political grounds, I certainly don't have a cause of action against them. Are you saying Right. Because the social media, there's no limitation? There's no limitation on how many letters can be published, like the New York Times has a limitation, that you would actually constrain the First Amendment rights of Facebook, of Twitter, and YouTube in the interest of creating a more global marketplace of ideas?
Sure. I think a couple of basic answers, right? I think that the right of Americans to speak freely on social media is more important than Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey's free association rights. And I think ultimately, you know, you would actually probably know this better than I do, but if I've talked to my dad about it and he says the same arguments were leveled against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, what about the free association rights of motel owners and restaurants, et cetera? And ultimately those had to give way to the underlying civil right. But the second point is, you know, this is sort of a novel use of 230, but Section 230 says that these companies are not the publisher, are not the speaker of these ideas. Okay, well, you're not the speaker. So to the extent that your freedom of speech rights are implicated, it's substantially less so than it would be otherwise. You know, we've already made the point, you've already carved out an exception in the law that says, look, we're not responsible for all this third party content. Don't sue us for defamation. Not our job. We're like, okay. But now you can't go, we think you should be a lot more constrained in terms of your picking and choosing who gets to speak and who doesn't, because if you're saying you don't want to be, go ahead.
Would you settle for the following compromise? Every media has to check a box. Yes, 230, no 230. If you want to take advantage of 230, then you can't be a publisher and you can't pick and choose. If you don't want to take advantage of 230, you check the negative box, and then you are the New York Times, and you don't get immunity from defamation. How about that?
I'd be okay with that compromise. I think that that's one way to handle it. Another way would be to essentially, you know, have a floor for the number of monthly users that this would apply to. So, you know, if you have, a few hundred million users every month, well, then at that point, nobody thinks you're the speaker of the content. Everybody knows you're just a platform where people are posting. You can't possibly moderate it all. But you're also so big that you're now a major locus of communication for Americans, which means there's now this public interest in ensuring that people are able to speak to make the First Amendment meaningful.
The other complaint that one hears from the social media is if you hold them responsible, then they have to engage in prior censorship. Right now, they engage in post-censorship. You can post anything you want, and then they take it down. But if they're responsible, then they would have to make sure that anything they posted passed whatever the test is that the government imposed. I mean, obviously, there you could also have a compromise and say you're not responsible for what's posted. You're only responsible for what you don't take down. How would you come down on that kind of an approach?
So, I'm more sympathetic to the tech companies on that point. Their whole business model is predicated on third-party content. So they can't, you know, I mean, if they're able to get their business off the ground, they sort of need some amount of protection from being held responsible for every piece of third-party content their users post. I get that. I'm sympathetic. This is why I'm not one of the people who's saying we need to just repeal Section 230. I think Section 230 was designed to solve a particular problem, this moderator's dilemma that they faced where they couldn't moderate at all if they wanted to avoid defamation liability. 230 solved that.
And for some people, 230 doesn't go far enough. Take, for example, a television or radio talk show. They invite me to be a guest. I'm a reasonable guest. I have some good credentials. And then I say something outrageous and defamatory on their platform, which is radio or television. Right now, they can be sued. Now, they'll win the suit, probably, because they can prove they didn't have malice and I'm a public figure. Or it depends who I defame. But what's true of YouTube and what's true of Facebook, to a degree, is true of talk radio, and it's not true of newspapers, but it's true of any media where things are said spontaneously. What they worry about is they will have to have an 8-second delay and have a lawyer in the room at all times to make sure that nothing defamatory is said. So we've already confronted those problems a bit on radio and television talk.
Yeah, and I agree that, you know, those are all, they're real problems. And I feel like that many people who are trying to protect free speech on the internet are they're often like libertarian types, so they're reluctant to just make new laws. For example, mm-hmm. This 230 was a law designed to deal with a defamation, liability issue. The problem we're not dealing right. with is defamation. It's censorship. And moreover, that's not actually a very good remedy for people who are the victims of censorship. Okay, you get banned on social media, so some other guy with a defamation claim can sue Twitter now. Like that what, how does that redress your harm or your injury?
I agree. And so, 90% of what's being censored is not defamatory. The election was fixed. That's not defamatory. It's wrong, but it's not defamatory. You don't defame anybody. We have to wind up in a couple of minutes. Two questions for you. Number one, if you were the czar of the First Amendment and the media, what two or three fixes would you try to put in? I know you want to reform universities. I'd like to do that, too. My one regret about retiring from Harvard 6 years ago is that I'm not there fighting against the forces of censorship right on the campus, which is so pervasive. So what are your fixes? And then the second question, which we'll end with, is how do people get to hear more of you? I think you're a fantastic voice and intellect, and people have to be able to access you more and more. So please, before we leave, tell us how to get more of you.
Well, thank you. So I guess if I'm the czar, I actually have to ask a question. How ridiculous can my czar actions be? Can they be truly, tyrannical, or do I need to be reasonable within the bounds of, government policy?
You're a benevolent czar. So benevolent you want to do only good things, right?
Okay, got it. All right. Well, okay. So I passed this law that creates a private right of action for Americans to go into court if their lawful speech is censored. And then I also probably make a diversity requirement for moderation teams. I think that these moderation teams, the problem is, they are looking for trust and safety, but it's an ideological monolith. So they only view it from the lens of, well, the right is dangerous. The right does all these things, but they never consider how the left does it. That's why.
Do you think Facebook has done that? They've now appointed a bevy of platonic guardians, former judges, former this and that. One law professor who's an extreme left-wing radical. I don't know what she's doing on this moderation board. But is that a decent approach, do you think, to try to remove the responsibility from Zuckerberg himself and put it on this group of guardians who will tell us what we can read and what we can see. Do you like that?
I mean, it's a slight improvement. I think that, but in general, it's still missing all the components of due process that you'd have if your speech was being censored by, for example, a public university campus. So where's notice? Where's the opportunity to be heard? Where's the idea of a consistent body of law that you can apply and appeal to a third part, you know, a neutral arbiter? I mean, is this body neutral? Well, it's just the one body that Facebook chose for itself. How balanced is it? It's not subject to democratic accountability, et cetera. I think that, you know, if we want to have a world where these sites continue to censor, I think that those protections need to be in place, because right now, you know, Twitter is effectively the legislator, the enforcement agency, and the adjudicator of every censorship dispute. That just, for when they're that big a center of public discourse, I think that's clearly off.
So. Okay, so where do we get more of you? We want more. We want more. We want more. Come on, give us an opportunity.
I appreciate that. Yeah,
find
so
you. Yeah,
you can find me. Okay, so first off, humanevents.com is our news and opinion website. You can find our articles there all the time. I am very active on Twitter at Will Chamberlain. That's probably the place where I'm most prominent. And I'm also on Periscope for the next 2 months at Will Chamberlain as well. And we have YouTube and Facebook, youtube.com/humanevents. That's where I regularly live stream. I think that's my most common method of communicating with people, is actually on live streams. You can catch the recordings, but I like to go live and interact with the audience and talk through legal issues and political issues when I can.
Do people ever ask you basketball questions, confusing you with a person who had a name similar to you?
This is the first time it's ever happened, Alan. It's never happened before that someone has noticed the similarity in my name to someone quite a bit taller.
My favorite Will Chamberlain story is, you know, Will Chamberlain famously said he had sex with 50,000 different women in his career. And another basketball player who was very, very well known for being a homebody and loving his wife said once on a radio interview that, you know, Will Chamberlain and I have something in common. Together, we've had sex with 50,001 women. So he got off a very good line there.
That's not bad.
And,
Not bad.
So let's remember, it's Will Chamberlain, shorter and in many ways more interesting. So please,
but not quite as prolific,
stay,
sadly.
No. please listen to Will and tune into his Twitter and his other accounts. And it's great to have you out there. You're a fresh voice, and a voice that makes me encouraged and optimistic about your generation, about the generation between yours and my grandchildren's. And so you've made me an optimist today. You know, in Israel, they say the difference between a pessimist and an optimist is a pessimist says, oy vey, things are so bad they can't possibly get worse. And an optimist says, yes, they can. So I'm an optimist. I think things can get worse. But I think when I interview somebody like you, I think things are going to get better. So thank you so much for your great insights and for speaking to my wonderful audience on The Dirt Show.
Thank you so much, Alan. It's been an honor. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. An important part of The Dirt Show is your voice, your questions, your comments. Please call 24/7. The number is 216-710-0050. Keep your comments short and to the point. Again, the number for you to call 24/7 is 216-710-0050. Hard questions, criticisms, everything's fine. Just keep your questions short, and I'll answer them all on The Dirt Show.